Are you looking for effective and low-friction ways to slash your living expenses and boost your savings rate? It's hard to overstate how powerful this can be to speed up your path to financial independence. We're going to help you take a look at your top three structural living expenses and root out inefficiencies there, as well as other expenses that you may not even know you're paying for. For more information, go to choosify.com/save. That's choosify.com/save. Hello, everyone. As promised, today we're going to dive into blockchain, cryptocurrencies, and NFTs. Depending on how much we're able to cover, we might have to break this up into a couple parts, but we're really going to take a stab at it. Very excited that you're joining us on the Ultimate Crowdsourced Personal Finance Show. This is Choose FI.
You're listening to Choose FI Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI, your home for financial independence online.
All right, guys, very excited to dive into this week's episode. And I admit a little bit of trepidation. There have certainly been a lot of people that have covered blockchain and cryptocurrencies from various perspectives, but we have not taken a stab at it from a personal level ourselves until now. So to help me with this, I have my co-host Brad here with me today. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, Jonathan, I'm doing quite well. Yeah, share your trepidation, actually. So yeah, it's
a good word, trepidation. I mean, it feels like it sets the stage.
Yeah, it is. It is a good word. I think if you had asked me like 14 months ago about, let's say, if I would ever have an interest in crypto or NFTs or Web3 or blockchain or whatever, I would have kind of said, no, this is not interesting. I think I'd held that belief since, 2017, when that whole Bitcoin craze happened and we did an episode on it. Like, it just didn't really interest me at all. I kind of thought it was junk, to be honest. Just kind of made up. I think one thing that I try to pride myself on is just keeping an open mind and always be, it's like, what's the saying? Strong convictions, loosely held, and just understanding that the world changes. Things change. My own knowledge of the world, the people that I come into contact with, it changes. So I, over the last, like I said, about 14 months, maybe a little less, I've been really, really trying to educate myself on this entire new world that's coming into existence. And I admit it's really, really fascinating. And I did not expect that. So before we get started with this, clearly none of this is financial advice. I'd actually be really thrilled if none of you invested, quote unquote, in this.
Don't take action on anything that we say in this episode.
unless you just want to learn. I think that, again, that's where I started. Like, nothing that we talk about is financial advice. So clearly, none of this is about making money. In all candor, like, in my estimation, 99% of cryptocurrencies that exist now will go to zero. 99%+ of what goes for NFTs now, which are just kind of fancy pictures or not so fancy in a lot of cases, I think 99.9% of them will go to zero. So, like, clearly this is not like an investment thing from my perspective. I think, and it's not like a trendy thing, right? Like, you hear about this a lot now, and is Choosify just jumping on the bandwagon? I mean, no. Again, this is something that I personally have spent hundreds or probably over 1,000 hours just researching and just trying to learn, like desperately trying to learn about over the last year. And I think it's just kind of time that we chat about it. And, you know, Jonathan, you and I are not experts by any means, but I think, you know, we both probably know more than 90 to 95% of people when it comes to blockchain and
NFT. It's a very low bar. I just want people to point out, this is not setting us apart in any way.
No. Not at all. No. I mean, in the least egotistical way humanly possible, right? Like, it is a very low bar. But again, I've been fascinated by this. So anyway, that's a very long intro of saying this is not like trendy financial advice. Nothing has changed with the FI thesis by any means. It is all about savings rate. It's all about being smart financially. But I think, frankly, people who have some financial wherewithal and some knowledge of the world and investing, there are potentially going to be businesses, world-changing businesses that come out of this entire new, as they're calling it, Web3 world. And I think if we stay on top of it, just like always with FI, it's about seeing down the field. It's about learning the rules of the game and understanding the rules of the world and seeing how you can benefit from that. So I think there's potential for this community to keep abreast of this and just try to be knowledgeable. So yeah, that's kind of where I'm approaching it from.
I would love to really frame this around conversations. You know, so we're having a conversation with each other and with you as the audience. And one of the things that we recognized in last week's episode was that what an opportunity if your kid comes to you and you guys are having a conversation about investing and they bring up the idea that, well, what about crypto or what about NFTs? Something about that has piqued their interest in investing and they want to invest and they're interested in what your thoughts are if they were to get started investing in crypto. What an amazing opportunity, a conversation to have. And most of us would probably just stifle it just out of fear and, you know, not really being able to go there. And so, you know, I think anything that you understand, you can teach in some varying capacity. And so providing kind of like a common framework for understanding what's happening and understanding the difference between a long-term investment and a speculative investment, understanding utility versus just hype, and really going through what are your various options out there and how do you avoid completely losing it all? What are the most dangerous, risky ways to interact with this space, I think would be useful for you as part of a conversation. And the problem is when you're looking at a website that will allow you to take your money and invest it, they don't really say, hey, this is high risk and this isn't, you know, like even Schwab, I think, or at least they used to, maybe they do, maybe they don't, would used to be like, if you wanted to invest in the stock market, fine. But if you wanted to do options, you had to go through an extended process, you know, to be able to invest in options because there you can lose your shirt. You can lose all your money. And guess what? I mean, I've literally seen people in a period of 15 minutes lose $1 million, you know,
in crypto.
Well, yes, in crypto, but the value of that amount in US dollars would have been $1 million.
Right, I meant in the crypto world.
In the crypto world, not in
options on stocks or something, but in the crypto world.
Right. And the thing is, a lot of the same things that would cause you to lose money in stocks are the same things that will cause you to lose all your money in crypto, except multiplied times 100 or 1,000, because things are so much more volatile. And because the markets and liquidity are generally smaller in a proportional terms to the overall stock market, massive moves can happen that us as small fish that are interacting here and there, we just don't have any control over at all. And so you just kind of need to be aware of, you know, where the danger zones are and be able to use that to foster, you know, these types of conversations.
Yeah. So I think the two kind of cardinal sins would be leverage, certainly as the number one, and maybe speculation, or like we talked about, the greater fool theory of like buying something and hoping to flip it to somebody else for a higher price, especially in potentially illiquid markets like a lot of these NFTs. So we'll talk about that later, obviously. But yeah, if you are quote unquote investing and expecting some other sucker to buy it from you an hour later for twice the price.
You just said investing in 1 hour later in the same sentence.
Right,
I'm sorry.
Isn't that what's so insane, right? But yeah, you need to be certainly guarded for the fact that you might not be able to sell that thing ever for a dollar. So, I mean, clearly speculation and leverage can destroy you.
It's almost like if you're trying to learn, you're almost by definition not investing. You're trying to see how something works. So get the word investing out of there. You're gambling. You're maybe putting some parameters around what your loss could be while finding out. It's a potentially a paid education with the possibility of massive profits on the other side.
Yeah, I like that paid education aspect, right? So like, you know, we talk about college and how much it costs. You're spending $50,000 a year for what, 10 classes of many of them of dubious quality or value. Whereas like, yeah, could you throw a couple $100 into, I don't know, pick whatever you want into this learning. And again, we're not using investing, but into this learning and just kind of play around with things and see how this works. See if this is interesting to you. See what you can learn. And, you know, I've seen people like Brian Feraldi, right, who we trust significantly. And he talked about, again, looking at this from like a holistic investing standpoint and just saying like, okay, if you're smart, and again, not engaging in leverage or speculation, but is there a potential for some of this crypto to be a tiny little percentage of your overall net worth when there's potentially asymmetric upside? I think that was kind of his argument. I don't necessarily want to put words in his mouth, but if you put 0.5% of your net worth or some tiny little bit but it 10x's, well, that's going to have an appreciable difference on your overall return. Whereas if it goes to zero, it's going to be a rounding error. So there's definitely some things to think about here in terms of, could this be something that I consider as an investment? Again, Jonathan, you and I here are talking just knowledge, information, not investment. But once you get to the point where you do feel comfortable, is there a place for a 0.5%, 1%, 2% of your net worth in this? Maybe, if you so choose. But again, I kind of like that thought of, okay, is this a calculated risk as opposed to a ridiculous, I'm going to put this on leverage, right, Jonathan? We can say this probably 50 times, like, no leverage. That is a catastrophe, an absolute catastrophe in the making. So please, please stay away from that as much as you possibly can.
Okay. Let's go ahead and we're not going to, you know, spend a whole episode just doing definitions of terms, but I think to really build this out, we need to get a couple worked in there. And so I think we start with just generally everything is happening on the blockchain, you know, just kind of as a general principle, something to understand. Brad, I went ahead and got this quick definition so I wouldn't put all of this on you. Basically, instead of being just one centralized machine, you have a system state that's spread across a set of machines. You have some sort of consensus about who owns what and when at what point of time. And I think what it allows, if you were to get through the noise of that, it allows transparency and accountability by making these actions that are happening in the system visible. So if an action is recorded in your blockchain, everyone can see it. If it's not in your blockchain, it's ignored, it is invalid. We have a record of truth, we have transparency, and that means something today more than ever.
Yeah, it definitely does. It is truly a public record of all the transactions that have occurred. So right now, and again, this is not indicative of what's going to happen 5 years from now, but right now, the vast majority of transactions occur on the Ethereum blockchain. And the cool thing is every single transaction is transparent and readily available. And there's a website called Etherscan, and you can literally look up every transaction that has ever occurred on the Ethereum blockchain. Simple as can be. So it actually, in a lot of senses, it makes record keeping, like for taxes and things like that, really, really easily, because it is a public blockchain, right? Every single one of those transactions, basically, it's akin, and Steven on our team explained this in a way that I really liked. It's akin to, we're all kind of getting in an auditorium, right? And one person stands up and said, I made this transaction. And everybody else in the auditorium scribbles it down in their ledger, and we all kind of agree on it. And that is what's happening. It's all of us agreeing on this ledger that something occurred. It is public. And again, you and I, Jonathan, are not in-depth experts on the blockchain. But when you have at least a bare bones basic conceptual framework of what's happening here, it becomes clearer that this is not just like some insider thing. It's the polar opposite of that. It is a public record where every single transaction is available and obvious to everyone else transacting on that blockchain.
So this just by itself presents a level of controversy, because how do you balance the needs of transparency in some systems with the needs for privacy in others, right? That is a major philosophical battle that's being fought right now and will lead to various regulations of various sorts. And it's very, very complex, but you can see why in mass, depending on what your needs for privacy are, you may or may not want everything to be on a ledger of truth, right? I mean, just for obvious reasons, everything is known by everybody and they can map everything out. And with the benefit of software on top of this, everything that may be very exciting to you in terms of knowing, like, imagine this on the converse side. I want people to know that I own my house. Like, I own my house. And right now it's embedded in some sort of bank. But then, you know, that small bank gets sold and goes somewhere else. Like, who actually has your mortgage at any point in time? What if those records were lost? We actually have in the house purchasing process a deed check, a title check, where a company is able to get money just to go investigate and make sure that the person who says they own their house actually owns their house. And that is there because our system is archaic. Now, theoretically, I'd love for everybody just to definitively know and not have to incorporate another $800 to $1,500 every single time a house is sold, to have someone double check to make sure the record is where it is. Theoretically, I'd like that. But conversely, I don't know if I'd want the outside forces to be able to see every single purchase that I've ever made just by that ledger of truth. The privacy versus transparency is a very serious thing that it's going to take time to figure out how to balance those two side by side.
Yeah. And I mean, you hit on a couple of really important things there. I mean, certainly it seems as if different blockchains are trying to balance that in different ways. And that, again, going back to, we don't know what this is going to look like a year from now, not less 5, 10, 50 years from now, right? Like, there's no way to predict what blockchain or blockchains are going to win. So like, if we sat here, or any expert sat here and said, not that we're experts by any means, but any expert actually came in here and said, oh, it's going to be X, you have no idea, right? There might be multiple in different use cases. And, you know, it's funny you brought up that specific example of the homes, because a lot of people use that example as, oh, what could blockchain actually do for the good, right? But you gave a potential downside to it. And also, like, the realistic case is every mortgage or every deed or title to every home or property in America going to go on a blockchain? Like, I mean, what would it take for that to actually happen? So there's a lot of like pie in the sky. And it's funny because I think theoretically, so that is very appealing to my brain, like thinking about something like, oh, what if all the properties were on the blockchain and it was so obvious and we didn't need these ridiculous helpers anymore, you know, to use like a Jack Bogle and Warren Buffett kind of term, all these helpers, these intermediaries, the people who, I don't know, authenticate or lawyers or whoever. Like, think about all the billions and billions of dollars that are just thrown down the drain on people authenticating things when it could just be done in a contract, in essence, a computer contract. That's what's really cool, again, from that theoretical pie in the sky type standpoint. But like, if you ask me, what is it going to take to get from here to there? I couldn't tell you. I mean, I couldn't tell you if it's even plausible. Like, are there going to be certain jurisdictions in America, like little towns and counties or whatever, like that eventually do this? Yeah, maybe. But like, are all of them? I doubt it very much.
You went down the mortgage blockchain rabbit hole, my friend.
Because it's super interesting, right? Like, that's, it's a cool use case. Again, like, you know, we're not trying to stand up as experts here. We're just trying to give anecdotes of like why this is intriguing. Like, I think that's a perfect example.
I think, I don't know what the timeline is, but 50 years from now, you know, we're going to be off analog. I don't know what it looks like. I don't know how they sort it, but 50 years from now, we'll be off analog. And it looks like in 2021, the world started figuring out how they could take the blockchain and start working it into everything that they were doing. So things are in motion. How will it shake out? We'll find out. So we have the blockchain, but that is not one-to-one the same thing as a cryptocurrency. And I know when we think of cryptocurrency, the canary in the coal mine, the one that probably since 2011 has been the flagship of all cryptocurrencies, has been Bitcoin. So Brad, I'd love to send this back to you. How does a cryptocurrency contrast with just a general blockchain?
Yeah, so I guess, again, definition of terms, we'll just go to Investopedia here. What is a cryptocurrency? A cryptocurrency is a digital or virtual currency that is secured by cryptography, which makes it nearly impossible to counterfeit or double spend. Many cryptocurrencies are decentralized networks based on blockchain technology, as we said before, a distributed ledger enforced by a disparate network of computers. And a defining feature of cryptocurrencies is that they are generally not issued by any central authority, rendering them theoretically immune to government interference or manipulation. So yeah, in general senses, you can, I guess, compare and contrast the, let's again use the Ethereum blockchain, because that's the one that I know the best. The blockchain is in existence, but the currency that is required to, I guess, they're known as gas fees. So they're transaction fees that occur every time a transaction takes place. So this gas, this is a payment right now to the miners. And now these are the people that basically, it's a kind of ridiculous term for the people that authenticate every transaction. Okay. And you pay this gas fee, this little bit, or maybe not so little in a lot of cases, which is one of the major issues with Ethereum right now. But you pay this fee every time that transaction occurs. So the ETH currency, the ETH cryptocurrency, is a absolute necessity to have in order to make any transaction on the Ethereum blockchain. So in many cases, the blockchain and the cryptocurrency are very, very, very closely linked. But they are distinct in that one is the blockchain, this ledger of record, and one is the actual currency that either, you know, it's not just certainly for the transactions. There are things of value you can pay for particular items, or, you know, NFTs, Jonathan, obviously, in their current incarnation are the most widely known. But you can just make payments. You could send Ethereum to another address and pay for something. I actually had, again, because these stories kind of make it interesting here, like I was on Twitter and I saw an artist who was in in Australia. He's a NFT artist. So he sells primarily, you know, NFT art, but he actually had a couple of real world things. And I asked him, oh, hey, how much would that cost? Just out of curiosity. And he quoted me, how much would that cost for me to buy the tangible item, not an NFT, but the tangible item, and you ship it to me from Australia. And he quoted me in Ethereum. So he wanted me to send him a payment of ETH on the Ethereum blockchain. And he was going to then send me this piece of art in the actual mail from Australia. So anyway, that's a kind of one silly little example, but like this is actual currency that has real world value is really the takeaway.
A couple things that come to my mind is we're talking about a currency or effectively here, a store of value, but the question and the potentially the opportunity or the reason that a lot of people got excited about cryptocurrencies, and then maybe a slight contrast to NFTs at this particular point in time, was that their store of value seemed to increase tremendously over time. So how much value they transmitted in relationship to the currency of a country, right? And so I don't think people realize this, but all currencies are really being compared to each other relatively and not to any specific non-moving store of value. So for instance, when you hear that the United States dollar is up 5% or the Chinese yuan is down, whatever, like these are in relationship to other currencies. So if all currencies are dropping in value at some relative rate, but one is dropping at a slightly lesser rate, it's considered to be up in value comparatively. It's a comparison. And so in terms of the Bitcoin store of value, going back to like 2011, and I don't have the numbers, but it was sub $1,000, I believe, easily, right, Brad? Like something, a couple $100, $300.
Yeah. And certainly when it started in 2009, it was essentially worthless, right? Like it had just come into creation. I think there's that famous story of like somebody buying a pizza with some absurd number of Bitcoin. It's annoying that I can't get it right. It was like 25,000 Bitcoin or something for a pizza. And that would be worth, I mean, literally billion? Like over $1 billion, I imagine, today.
Most expensive pizza ever.
Yeah. It might've been 10,000 or something like that.
So this is really it. So like, how do we identify how much a cryptocurrency is worth? And when you look at the trend line for Bitcoin, despite all the volatility, when you look at it over a 10-year period, it seems to be literally just straight up. It is a rocket ship. Now, if you zoom in a little bit, you've seen multiple 50 and 60% declines. So not everybody experienced the moon. There were a lot of people that bought at the top of one of these peaks and have still not recovered, you know, but if you had a long enough timeline on Bitcoin, you've been thrilled, beyond thrilled with what it's actually done. But I think what we need to really zone in here, and we're gonna expand on this idea, but I want to zone in on is that how do we figure out what a cryptocurrency is worth? How do we figure out how to value it, right? Because it's the difference that presents the opportunity. The what you can buy it for versus what it's actually worth tells you whether or not there's an opportunity, money to be made for a potential investor. And the problem is, although we potentially have various tools like price to earnings ratio that we've talked about with Brian Feraldi inside of the stock markets, equities, it's a pretty gray space when it comes to establishing the value or the worth at any particular point in time of a cryptocurrency.
Yeah, I'm kind of sitting here chuckling to myself because I'm wondering if you're going to undertake how to value a cryptocurrency because you're a braver man than I am. That's for damn sure. Right, because I think that is ultimately, and I'm just kidding with you here because you have a very valid point, and I'm curious to hear you expand on that. But like, that is something that I don't know that anybody could truly answer right now. Like, what is a Bitcoin worth? It's worth what someone's willing to pay for it at the time, right? Like, does it have inherent value to it?
And the liquidity in the pool at the time, and maybe the project's utility that are on the pipe. Like, there are some factors you could look at, but I just want to point out to people right here. Technical analysis in crypto space is a total joke.
Oh, yeah.
Like that you will see an insane number of influencers, we'll use the word influencers in this case, in the crypto sphere that will show you cup and handles till the cows come home. And they just delete their tweets when they don't manifest. I mean, it is just unbelievable the amount of missed predictions on what some technical analysis would prove, some Fibonacci sequence would have proven about where they have no clue.
No, it's all junk. I mean, there's a lot. What you're saying is there's a whole bunch of snake oil salesmen in this crypto world, maybe more so than anywhere I've ever seen, even more than in like the bowels of the stock market investing, YouTube and places like that. Like, you need to be really skeptical. And I think that, again, is why we're not saying this is an investment, really, and why you have to be really cautious. And this is just a learning thing. Because, right, if somebody asked me, like make a bet. What is Bitcoin worth or what is anything worth? I mean, I could not tell you. I couldn't tell you what it's going to sell for a year from now or 2 years. I have no clue whatsoever. And like anything else, it's ultimately a fool's errand. So, I mean, I think there are items you can look to. Like, while I personally am, there are a lot of like what's known as like Bitcoin maximalists, like people who have like a basically essentially theological love for Bitcoin. And like, I think their strongest point is that there is a finite number of Bitcoin that will ever exist. And scarcity is something that just drives human behavior to a large degree. And like, there are only going to be 21 million Bitcoin ever produced in existence. Sure, it's subdividable down to what's known as a Satoshi, which is a 100 millionth of a Bitcoin.
How many Satoshis you got, Brad?
No comment. But yeah, like there's going to be 21 million of these things for what, 7+ billion people that currently exist. So for the people who believe, and strongly believe at that, that Bitcoin is going to be whatever it's going to be, the world's currency or the reserve currency or digital gold or whatever it is, like their strongest case is there's only 21 million of these for 7 or 8 billion people. And I'll buy that. You know, I mean, from a perspective, there is logic to that.
Hey, this is Andrew from the ChooseFI team. Hope you're enjoying the show. We're going to get right back to it after these quick messages. Here at ChooseFI, we cannot recommend M1 Finance enough. It's one of the best platforms around. We love the tools, flexibility, and power M1 gives us over our money. And that's just the free version. Turns out, it gets a whole lot better when you sign up for M1 Plus. With M1 Plus, you can do more with every dollar thanks to a second trade window and smart transfers, basically automated rules that let you direct your money where you want. You'll also get some of the highest rates around on your checking balance. At any rate, we're big fans. Still on the fence? Your first year of M1 Plus is free, and it's $125 a year after that, and you can cancel at any time. To get started, head to m1finance.com/choosefi. For a limited time, you can earn up to $500 when you join M1 and fund an account. Terms and conditions apply. And remember, all investing involves risk. To get started, go to m1finance.com/choosefi. That's m1finance.com/choosefi.
All right, so you've heard us talk about the books that ChooseFI Publishing has released over the last year. There's ChooseFI, Your Blueprint to Financial Independence, The Golden Albatross, How to Determine if Your Pension is Worth It, and Raising Your Money Savvy Family for Next Generation Financial Independence. These books are incredible. We've spoken with all the authors, and I think they add a ton of value, both as a present, frankly, for people who just might not be interested in podcasts, they might not read blogs, or for yourself. Right now, we're actually offering the ebooks in a bundle on our website. How it's working is we're offering all three of these for a 25% discount. Or if you're looking for just two of them, a 20% discount off the already low ebook price. So head to choosefi.com/ebooks, and that'll take you to the page with all the different options and enjoy the books. I think they really will add a lot of value to your life.
We started out this conversation by saying, you know, we really want to encourage you to focus on investments versus speculation, just generally have a long-term mindset. And let's just give one piece of credit to individuals that would consider themselves Bitcoin maxis. And Brad, you used the word fundamentalist on the other side of that. They are looking at this as a long-term investment. They do not care what the price does over an intervening period of time. And when it goes down, they're buying the dip. You know, you're not coming to the scene in 2011 or 2012 or 2013, you're potentially thinking about it right now. And there were individuals that were advising people publicly on Twitter with massive followings to mortgage their house, take out a second lease, bar up to the eyeballs, and throw everything into Bitcoin at 69,000 because it's guaranteed to go to 100,000 by the end of the year. Now it's at 41. Now it could be at 65 by the time this episode releases. I don't know, but I just want to point out that you might believe in a long-term investment. You might. But let me tell you what, when you make your first stab at something and then it gets cut in half, it's pretty painful. So the point here being, we've really got to put a little, if you're going to take that approach and buy something when it's hitting an all-time high because you believe in the future, I think the best predictor of what Bitcoin is about to do is like the fear greed score, you know, or how many people are posting on it in any particular group. Because when all the posts are coming in, you know, the top is almost there. you know, the top is almost there. As opposed to maybe right now where like the fear score on Bitcoin was like at a 10, it was like a crazy high fear score. Like maybe that tells you that you're at, you know, it's something along those lines. This is really what we have to work with in terms of like where we are. This is better and probably more accurate than any technical analysis that I've seen over, you know, the last several years.
Yeah.
Anyways, all that to be said, because we're going to keep moving through cryptocurrency and we're about to start layering on smart contracts here in just a second. But I want to say that the way that people made money for the first several years of cryptocurrency was to buy low and sell high. Buy low and sell high. So it was clearly, it was like, you know, sell it to someone else who's going to pay much more for it. And while that will carry through in some varying degree, that is not the only way to make money in digital currency. And Brad, at the beginning of the conversation, you were talking about, you know, how 99% of things that are out here right now will fail. I don't think people have appreciation for how history has borne that out in so many different industries. I know you and I both use Google just as our primary browser, along with probably like 70, 80% of the audience. And Google has massive, massive market share. But if you went back just a mere like 10 or 15 years ago, the clear winner that had like Google's like the 20th search engine to show up. The clear winner 10 or 15 years ago was Yahoo. Yahoo was like the clear winner. And that was the one that clearly won on tops of the backs of all the work that websites like Ask Jeeves and AltaVista and Ask.com, all of those came in. So just because something has the most market share and is the most popular and has the most adoption does not mean that it will be here 10 or 20 or 30 years from now in a space where technology is going faster and faster. Adoption is happening faster and faster. Evolution and the needs of what people have are sparking new ideas and pivots. So Bitcoin, and I know it sounds kind of bearish, but it's just more like we want to just kind of go in with eyes wide open. We're not, I don't know which coin, you know, will come out of this as the top, but these are just things to consider. Bitcoin has forked like 6 or 7 times to fix different things that users felt were a problem. And even now, one of the biggest problems that Bitcoin specifically has is it's kind of slow. It's kind of slow. It can process around 6 transactions a second, which if you're talking about a coin that's going to represent, you know, be digital gold and be the way the world interacts with each other, doesn't scale. So Bitcoin, even right now, is in the process of developing new technology, a layer 2 protocol, which is outside the scope of this conversation, called the Lightning Network, which is going to lift on top to hopefully elevate the number of transactions that Bitcoin can process per second. Because even the most hardcore fundamentalists know that 6 transactions a second doesn't cut it when they get the mass adoption that they're hoping for. So Bitcoin is trying to pivot its model at the same time as literally at this point, 20 of this recording, 10,000 other cryptocurrencies that are in existence. Everyone wants to be at the top, wants to be at the top, and it's a cutthroat game. I have no real incentives in any of them at this particular point in time, but it'll be very interesting to see how it all plays out.
Yeah, no, it certainly will. And like you said, there's no way to know, but it's really interesting that you look at this technology and you say, okay, there's a lot of really smart people moving into this entire sphere. And like, I view that as like just really hopeful. Like, I have no idea where this is going to go, but I find that exciting. I have a quote. So episode 542 of the Tim Ferriss podcast, I would highly recommend to anyone interested, you know, you're listening to this, go download that after you listen to this. And Tim said, I've never seen so many highly intelligent, ambitious, capable people drop whatever they are doing. In many cases, really attractive things to dedicate all their time to this. And they were talking about Web3, NFTs, crypto. I've never seen anything approaching it en masse. It's not a trickle that slowly builds. It's people immediately deciding this is what they want to spend their 24/7 time on. In all of my time in around technology, which for him, it's been 20 to 30 years, I've just never seen anything like it. And at the very least, that means it's something that's worth taking a very close look at. And I totally agree with that. And I think like there's ways, you know, Jonathan, we're talking about very specifically like the two biggest current cryptocurrencies, right? So, and kind of comparing, contrasting. So Bitcoin, like we said, that's the granddaddy, right? It came around way, way back in January of 2009. And that is, like we've said, what people think of as akin to digital gold. It's pretty inert. It just sits there. There's essentially nothing transacting on the Bitcoin blockchain right now. There's basically people just keeping it as their store of value, as their gold, as part of their net worth for the people who believe in that. And that's fine. I mean, I guess there's that use case for it and people do believe very strongly in it. And, you know, when I was approaching this, I started, okay, this Bitcoin thing, does this appeal to me? And I mean, the answer honestly was no, because regular gold doesn't appeal to me. I mean, Jonathan, how many times have I given the Warren Buffett quote about gold just kind of sitting there doing nothing, as opposed to you could have all the gold in the world, or you could have, at that time, you know, his quote is a little outdated now, but something like 16 ExxonMobils and all of the farmland in the US. You know, and it's like, which would you rather have, something productive or something that sits there? So for me, the answer very obviously is something productive. And that's what led me, again, in my research, and I would advise everyone out there to do your own research. This is not financial advice by any means, but my research was, okay, what's actually happening today? Where are things going down? Where are transactions? Where are the smartest people? Where's all the innovation actually happening? And for me, it very clearly was on this Ethereum blockchain. And again, I don't know if Ethereum is going to exist 10 years from now. That's beside the point. It's just today, where was all the interesting stuff happening? And it was there. So I looked at it and said, okay, again, in order for anything to take place on the Ethereum blockchain, you need to have this Ether or ETH as gas to pay for it. So at the time when I first started getting into this world of cryptocurrency and such, Ethereum was like, it was $600 for one ETH. And I'm like, oh, wow, this is really interesting, right? So like, this is a requirement. And for every transaction and everything I see, all the smart people that I see are moving all of their technology, all their innovation to the Ethereum blockchain. So I was like, oh, this actually makes some sense. This might be worth me, you know, again, speculating, but invest whatever you want to, whatever word you want to use to describe it in this a little bit. And, you know, I tried to then educate myself, but again, with strong convictions loosely held, right? And that wasn't even a strong conviction. That was just, okay, this at least makes sense to the way my brain works. And I think all of our brains work differently. All of our past knowledge and experience are different, right? And I'm not saying that's the only answer, because again, there are what a lot of people call like ETH killers coming up. There are different blockchains like Solana and Avalanche and other things that maybe are a little bit cheaper to transact on, or, you know, that whatever, fill in X new technology or innovation that's happening there. Those things might be the number one a year from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now. I have no idea. I'm not trying to predict. I take all of the experience that I have in my life, and that's how I try to apply it, to just try to compare almost like an apples to apples, to try to make sense of something that really, on the face of it, is hard to wrap your mind around.
So, you know, as we work through these, I think one of the things we should talk about with Ethereum, because, you know, Ethereum has some similar, albeit slightly different problems as well. In particular, you mentioned the word gas fees a little bit. The way people should think about this is when you want to do a wire transfer of almost any amount is going to cost you around $45. I don't think it's a percentage.
At a regular bank, right?
Yeah, at a regular bank. And you could do $100,000, $200,000. I'm sure it goes up over time. But, you know, if you want to send $1 million or $1 billion, it's probably going to be, you know, many multiples. That's an analog process. Well, Ethereum, these gas fees are notable. Like, you should just be aware of that. So I don't think it has the same problem with speed. I think it's relatively fast compared to Bitcoin, and it's clearly being massively used. But one of the ways that it makes up for that speed is to prioritize, I believe, transactions that have higher gas fees. And so the more activity on the network at any particular point in time, that dries up the cost of that transaction, that gas fee, that wire transfer fee, however you want to visualize that in your mind. And there have been examples where individuals have been able to try to send $10 in value. So that's a very tiny fractional amount of Ethereum. But the amount of gas that they would have had to spend to do that was $20 or $30, you know, and that has happened many, many times. Now, I believe, Brad, and I know since you've been in the space, you know a lot more, there are different answers and solutions that have been implemented, like layer twos that are going on top of that. And maybe you could speak to that a little bit, but it's not like anything that we're seeing right now is fixed.
No.
Nothing is set. Nothing is perfect.
Not even close. And that's why, yeah, doing your research, just learning about this, like, and we all are still at the infancy of this. And yeah, there's no clear answer. Because like you said, yeah, the Ethereum blockchain, while that I think almost unquestionably is the number one blockchain in terms of activity right now, I mean, it has significant issues, right? And what you said is a number one, that there are only a finite number of transactions that can occur worldwide at any given moment. And the more gas you pay, the higher likelihood you're actually going to get prioritized, your transaction be included in that block, right? It is a chain of blocks. So in that block, you're paying gas fee. If you decide, hey, I want to pay 10 times as much to get in this one, you can do that, right? And who wins then? Rich people do. Whales do. So that's not the way that a worldwide ledger of record is going to win.
That's not delivering the promise of low cost, fair-handed transaction balance.
Clearly. No. And what are we talking about all the time? Like, my biggest financial advice for people is, like, cut out fees everywhere you can in your life, because they're just not necessary in most senses. So it's rather hypocritical of me to say that, oh, this is the number one blockchain. And I'm not saying that, obviously, but like, and yet the fees cost $20, $50, $100 to make any transaction. You can't actually operate on that, right? So like, even if you were so inclined to quote unquote invest, you have to do it in such large increments that otherwise, like, your fees, as you said, eat up everything. So like, you almost by definition can't invest like in tiny little amounts or dollar cost average, or they're actually like index funds, that which is actually really cool, like a cool use case that appeals to us. Like, there are index funds of different companies in the, I don't know, decentralized finance, or you can buy an index fund of a little bit of Ethereum, a little bit of Bitcoin, a little bit of this. Like, that's actually pretty cool. But since it operates on the Ethereum network, Jonathan, you have to pay these ridiculous gas fees. So like, you can't do that in dollar cost average. So anyway, what you said was, like, are there solutions coming? Yeah, in theory, like, and way beyond the scope of this podcast, or really like my conceptual knowledge, but, or my ability to explain technically, let's say, but like these layer twos, similar to that Lightning network you mentioned for the layer two of Bitcoin, that's what there is going to be on Ethereum, which is basically, okay, we're going to kind of aggregate one site or whatever might aggregate a bunch of smaller transactions and kind of roll them up into one transaction that then occurs at the base level, that layer one, which, you know, is the Ethereum blockchain. So yeah, the upshot of that is you are, I guess, paying dramatically less in fees, right? But I guess in theory, you're giving up a little bit in security is the argument, because you're not, the transaction is not occurring on the actual ledger of record. It's occurring at this other level, and it's all kind of getting rolled into one and then sent up, and you're trusting another party, et cetera. You know, this is all beyond the scope of like what you and I would think about.
It is. And at the same point, it is exactly just what we need to, we don't need to know it at like,
right.
We have a solution. We don't, there are people working on it, but we do need to know what the downside of these investments are if we have a long-term buy and hold thesis on anything. And the two that we just talked about really set us up perfectly to just, we're not going to discuss all 9,000 cryptos, but just in general thinking through them, what is the transaction speed and the utility? That's what we're talking about with Bitcoin. The Bitcoin that, you know, doesn't have utility. What is the transaction fee? Does it act as a good store of value? You got to go through those considerations. What is its future outlook? Okay, then we move through that and we say, all right, so Ethereum, it's improved the transaction speed to some varying degree. Gas fees, what is the cost of a transaction? And then what is the adoption and the utility? So we have, all right, better transactions, but there's something that feels broken and everybody knows it with the transaction fees. There's some solution that's implemented. All right, do we have confidence in that solution? Maybe, maybe not. What about the adoption? Adoption is hard to gain, but also somewhat hard to lose. They have a first stake in the ground and they have a lot of companies that have built their products on top of it. Does that build them, as Warren Buffett would say, a moat? Maybe, maybe not. Something worth considering. The one thing that we've moved into a different category, though, is that with Ethereum, in contrast to Bitcoin, we're now for the first time really talking about this concept of smart contracts. And so, Brad, I'll give it back to you for smart contracts.
Yeah, Jonathan, I think this is one of the aspects that stands out the most about, I guess, in particular, the Ethereum blockchain, that these smart contracts, as they're called, they're basically, again, when most of us think about contracts in the quote-unquote real world, we think about having those helpers in the middle, right? You have a lawyer who writes it up. You have someone that has to, I guess, authenticate ultimately, or determine, like, did the conditions of this contract get met? They have to agree on it. You know, you're paying fees to lawyers and other intermediaries, right? Like, it's a very, as you said, analog process. It's a very labor intensive process, as opposed to a smart contract is essentially, think of that type of contract, but storing it and writing that contract on the blockchain. And there are specific, I guess, coding languages, if you will. There's one called Solidity, which I think is essentially the smart contract coding language for Ethereum currently. And I'm sorry that we're spending so much time on Ethereum. It's just that, again, that is where today most of the activity is, but we're not trying to imply that that's the be all end all by any means. But basically, once the conditions of that contract are met, then in essence, that program is executed. So that contract is executed, And a lot of them can be done just electronically. Like, it's just very simple. Were those conditions met? If so, the contract runs itself. And in other cases, and Jonathan, this is where like kind of picks and shovels comes in. You mentioned that before, like as a way of investing. I think before we went online, you were talking about like the gold rush. And I'd love for you to talk about that, because I think there are different investing strategies in a lot of this stuff, right? Like, you can try to pick right, which is ultimately speculating on which cryptocurrency, or maybe you can buy, as they call it, like the picks and shovels, like what's a requirement in order to, like in this case, you know, and I want you to explain it here, like the gold rush, like what were the picks and shovels? What were the requirements necessary in order to get gold out of the ground?
So Brad, if you were, you know, an adult during the 1800 gold rush in San Francisco, and you have kind of a disdain for what gold is as an investment tool, you know, like, oh, it just sits in my backyard, you know, but you also value being able to generate a proper income. What many individuals did very, very successfully is they identified that there was demand for gold, for mining this gold. And so they built a business around selling, you know, pickaxes and shovels in this case. They provided the tools that individuals needed to go do whatever it is that they wanted to do, right? And it worked out remarkably well, because finding gold was a lottery, and, you know, they were digging holes all over the place, and many of them did not find what they were looking for, or worked countless hours for rounding errors of gold. But consistently, the business owners that were selling supplies to the miners, it's really actually the analogy actually holds up really well, right? Even now, right? They're providing the supplies to the miners. They made, you know, I don't know if it was millions, but they made massive amounts of money in the dollars in their time, inflation adjusted. It was a very profitable business. And so that theme really serves us right now. And the point with the smart contract is, while a cryptocurrency is a store of value that's transmitted over a blockchain, the concept of a smart contract is we can build whatever we want on the blockchain. We can take your creative code, your creative ideas, and it's not just transmitting store of value. It's rather bringing the world onto it. And who else has heard that there is a metaverse that's happening? Who else has heard about video games that are starting to be built on there, and video streaming services that are starting to be, you know, brought over to the block? Like, I don't know what the end solution will be, but you're only limited by creativity, and humanity historically has proven to be very creative, with the benefit of evolving. One generation evolves on the prior legwork that's been done by the prior.
Right.
Right. And so if you're always, you know, building on that prior baseline, technology just keeps it speeding up faster and faster and faster.
Yeah. And what's super interesting about like these smart contracts, so there are, like I said before, there are ones that just occur on the blockchain. You need no real world intervention, let's say. So for instance, going back to NFTs, but let's not use that phrase, just a piece of art, right? So an artist creates a piece of art, whether this is real world or not, but let's just say they create a piece of digital art, okay? They sell that for a certain price on day one, and it's usually denominated currently, again, in Ethereum. So let's say they sell it for 0.1 of an Ethereum, right? As we're recording this, that's a little more than $300. And in the real world, up to this point in life, when an artist sells something, that's the end of it, right? They make money that very first time. And whether you're Picasso or, you know, my daughter who's selling, you know, paint by numbers or whatever it is.
Is your daughter selling paint by number NFTs? No. Is that like a real story?
Let's no, that would be cooler. It'd
be pretty cool.
Be a lot cooler if it was, right?
insert Matthew McConaughey voice right here.
Yeah, I wish I could do that. But anyway, so with a smart contract, however, like when that NFT is created, when that piece of digital art is created, they can build into the contract that every single time that is resold in the future, that something occurs. And it occurs automatically. So now, an example I've given on this podcast before, when we've spent probably 10 minutes talking about this, is, okay, very obviously, they can build a royalty into it. So they get X percent, they, the original, the creator, the artist, they get X percent every time that's sold. So whether that's next year for 0.15 Ethereum, or they become world famous and it's 10 years later and it's 10,000 Ethereum, right? They get a certain percentage. But the cool thing about a smart contract is you're not limited to anything. You could build whatever you want. You could build into it that the very first purchaser of that piece of art also gets a royalty every time it's resold, right? You want to build incentives into something? You want to build incentives for this getting sold the first time? Give that original purchaser a little cut of the pie every time it gets resold for the future.
All right, that's kind of cool.
Right? How cool would that be?
Yeah, that is.
You could
cool.
build anything. That's what's amazing. Like, again,
Brad has been trying to get me to like get excited about just the concept for a while, and I don't want to interrupt you, but I just want to point out to people, we're not on the same page necessarily. Like, no. The consensus will not be found. So you don't need to totally agree and be one-to-one lockstep with another individual's investing decisions to generally appreciate some of the concepts that we're going through. Because just this is what is happening. It is what is happening. So I have been, and maybe it'll come through, a little cynical on NFTs generally, right click, save as. And Brad has been very much from different angles trying to show me or illuminate some of the other ways that this might be applicable. And let me just say, I very much am a huge fan of if then clauses and logic built clauses in any sort of business building venture. And so if this, then that is. That's smart contracts, Brad.
Yeah. Jonathan, this warms my heart. I mean, seriously, that was the first time I could see it on your face. The very first time that I've even like slightly cracked the Jonathan facade of like, this could actually change the world. Like, I think it will, right?
Well, maybe. There was a JPEG that sold for $60 million, and then I just shut off.
I mean, that's ridiculous stuff.
And, right, but we've set ourselves up perfectly. We have, without really intending it, defined smart contract and set ourselves up to talk about NFTs, which, just as a definition, stands for non-fungible token. So Brad, you know, with regards to smart contracts and NFTs, I think the actual word there is really key for people to understand: fungible versus non-fungible. It's not that one's good and one's bad. It speaks to a different use case.
Definitely, without a doubt. So yeah, I mean, fungible is, we've described this so many times on the podcast, money is fungible. Right. In essence, sure, a dollar bill technically has its own serial number. It's, I guess, if you wanted to make a real logical leap, you could say it's non-fungible because it's technically different. But by any logic, a dollar is fungible because one is the same as another. Right. It doesn't matter if you have a dollar bill here in Richmond, Virginia, or somebody has a dollar bill in San Francisco, $1 is $1. They are interchangeable, just like one Bitcoin is fungible with another Bitcoin, just like one Ether is fungible with another Ether. They are the exact same thing. Whereas something that is non-fungible is, in theory, completely unique. That's, at the very highest level, the definition of non-fungible. A non-fungible token is a completely unique item that is really, you know, again, it's funny with this JPEG thing, and I don't know that people who are just getting into, if this is the first time they've ever heard any of this, they're probably not getting the joke. But the joke, and Jonathan, you could probably tell it better than I can, but the joke clearly is that what goes for 99.9% of NFTs right now, and why people like Jonathan are so skeptical just on the face of it, is if you thought of NFTs today in January of 2022, they are little pictures, mostly of like monkeys and other random things, right? And that's the extent of them. And if you just saw it as that's it, they are literally JPEGs that you could just save for free, or you could spend $1,000, $100,000, $200,000, whatever,
you know,
it
that
is.
Meme of that dude sitting at a table with a coffee cup and a sign that says, convince me I'm wrong.
Right.
Like, I can't be convinced. Yeah. You just paid $1 million for an ape that is now your Twitter profile, and you share a Twitter feed that says, hey, I just spent $1 million and now this thing is mine. I'm like, out of spite, going to go Loom video, right click, save as, make it my profile picture, and said, hey, thanks, cool. You know, like, who cares?
Yeah. And I mean, the ultimate answer is none of us care, right? None of us care about that. But again, it's like, to me, it's that technology, it's that future use case. And it's hard to see down the field precisely what it's going to be. But actually, if you'll humor me, I have another quote that I think it kind of describes like a little bit of that skepticism that existed really like at the infancy of the internet. And I think, honestly, like, this change of this NFT type technology is going to be a 0-1, almost on the level of no internet to internet is no NFTs to NFTs. That's where I see this going. And on that same episode of the Tim Ferriss podcast, so Chris Dixon was the guest. He's a general partner at the VC firm Andreessen Horowitz. And this is a little bit longer of a quote, but I think it's really important. And he said, I think of an NFT as, it's as general a concept as the web page. Think about the early websites. When it first comes out, people are like, oh, it's a website. and they tried to map it just to the offline world. And how he described that was similar to like, oh, we have a newspaper. Let's just copy and paste that newspaper onto this website. And he's saying here, it's like a brochure. But then we saw over this 30-year period, all these clever people came and they innovated. It's not a website. It's not just a website. It's a social network. It's a SaaS tool. It's a this, it's a that. NFTs are going to be just as broad. It's a new core concept. The idea of owning something on the internet. Another way I like to think about it is to imagine if in the real world, we couldn't own anything. And every time you go, and he said, this is kind of a wacky analogy. Every time you go to a hotel or a restaurant, you've got to change your clothes and buy a new outfit. That's how the internet works today. And then you leave and you have to give all that stuff back. And what he's ultimately saying is every place you go on the internet, Facebook, they own the rails there. They control 100% of it, right? Jonathan, we have a Facebook group with 80,000 people in it, but you and I should never fool ourselves that Facebook tomorrow could say, delete, see you, Chooseify, right? Like we don't own any of that. And then back to Dixon's quote here, and he said, but then one day somebody comes along and says, no, you can take it with you. Imagine the amount of innovation that would kick off. That's kind of what's been going on in the internet. We've had this renting fiefdom design, a la Facebook, my insert, and we just kind of broken it open. And so people say, oh, it's a bubble, right? The Jonathans, the NFTs, it's just
the
a bubble.
The Jonathans?
Yep. And this and that. But I think it's the beginning of this incredible 20-year creative run. And I think that to me is what's so exciting. Sorry, buddy. You know, I'm just playing with you. But
you're fine,
like,
dude.
That to me is like is the excitement of this. It's like we cannot possibly know where this is going. But as Ferris said, basically, you've never seen a scenario where all of the smart, ambitious people in tech around the world have dropped everything and said, this is going to change the world. And they're all working on making it change the world. So like that to me is the most exciting thing I've ever seen. And I hate to keep repeating this over and over. Like I can't predict what it's going to look like 10 years from now, but I am so excited about it. And like that gets me up every single morning to find out like, what can I learn about this?
Hey everyone, hope you enjoyed this primer on blockchain, smart contracts, and NFTs. This is an extended conversation and we broke it up into two episodes. We'll release the second part next week and we're really going to focus in on those smart contracts and NFT functionality and what that might mean for the future, both in terms of speculating on a digital JPEG or figuring out how to leverage the underlying utility or the underlying market demand for these items to build recurring passive income in a time where the landscape is changing so very rapidly. Most importantly, we're going to be talking about how not to lose everything in crypto. All right, my friends, the fire is spreading. We'll see you next time as we continue to go down the road less traveled.